Hello, and welcome to Optimist Economy. I'm Catherine.
I'm Robin.
On this show, we believe the U.S. economy can be better, and we talk about how to get there one problem and solution at a time.
At the top of the show, we like to do a few little announcements. First of all, hey, we've been messing around with paid advertising to see if that would work on our platform, and I accidentally turned it on. So if you got an ad for the Beef Council or ZipRecruiter, my bad.
But if you got an ad for Starbucks, please let us know.
Amazon.
Starbucks, Amazon, the Bezos family. Like, if you got an ad that's actually funny, like, please write in and let us know. It was only on
at the very, very end.
Very, very end. So it's also, this is a measure that you are truly a devoted listener because it came on after we snap out Andy and Sophie. But the Beef Council, great. I got ZipRecruiter.
Oh, and we found out that we earned $7.25. The minimum wage.
Exactly. The exact minimum wage is what we earned from accidentally putting on ads. I can't. Oh, seven. If it had been 726, it would have been worse. The fact it was 725 was just, ugh,
yeah,
chef's kiss.
Perfect. Yeah.
Totally perfect. And then also the usual announcements about how we need money. It's either these awkward calls for money or ads from the Beef Council. Like, you tell us what you want. But we have a website, optimisteconomy.com. We will take your money in any way we can find ourselves capable of actually accepting it, which has been a struggle these many months. And we have an email, optimist.economy@gmail.com. We love to hear from you. We also really, really love, we really love your reviews. My favorite one from this past week was just, "This show is a chaotic mess."
Really, you didn't like the, your gays are listening?
Oh, and your gays are listening. Yeah, the gays are listening. That I loved, but the chaotic mess, I was like,
yeah, you don't even know. You have no idea.
All right. Okay. So, retcon.
One of the things that I, because of the topic that's coming up that I was looking into, I don't know, spoiler alert, we're going to talk about happiness. And some of the data that I was looking at suggests that actually in terms of feeling like their mental health is good, women are actually suffering from this way worse than men right now. We'll talk a little bit more in detail about this, but 24% of 18 to 29-year-olds report excellent mental health, and it's only 15% of women in that age group. And a decade ago, that was 48%. This is Gallup polling.
Something I didn't say very clearly in the show is that there is a difference between like a boy problem and a problem that boys are among the affected, mm-hmm. or a men's problem.
Or disproportionately affected, yeah.
Or disproportionately affected. Yeah. There was an op-ed that came out after we recorded the show from Rahm Emanuel in the Washington Post that said, like, the housing crisis is driving the boys and men crisis. And how not being able to afford a home is something that hits young men particularly hard. And I...
But it was also, if we want to address the crisis that boys are facing, because that's so important, we need to fix the housing crisis. And I was just like, who edited this?
I think I was like, oh, okay. So like, to make any problem relevant, we're just going to like throw boys and men on it. Like,
and you're going to mention Richard Reeves.
Yeah. Like, here's Richard Reeves. Here's the Boys and Men Institute. And
triangulate
like
with your problem.
Yeah. Now housing is a boy's problem. And now this, and I, it felt like,
oh God, it was infuriating.
It was a bit of an infuriating article, but I think what his op-ed in some ways solidified to me about this whole conversation is how much the actual problems of boys and men are going to be erased by the bandwagon of saying a problem is about boys and men. Mm. And it does a disservice to that population to be like, oh, actually it's housing, or like, actually it's this. And it's just erasing the people who are actually suffering to pick your issue and give it to boys and men and say, well, this is another boys and men issue. Mm. And I was like, yep, okay.
Yeah.
Because if we fixed housing, labor force participation would turn around and
exactly.
Like all these problems with disability would go away.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So would the, you know, difficulty in finding a job if you have a felony record. Like, as long as you know.
The fentanyl crisis would be gone.
Yeah, as long as you know that there's a house you could afford one day, the fact that you don't have a job to get you there, like it just, it was so.
It's jumped the shark as a conversation framing device.
Well, that actually is pretty close to my term and condition.
Okay. Terms and conditions.
Terms and conditions is our next Pilcro. And
you're not going to let that go, are you?
The Pilcro? Yeah. I don't think so. You can ask my family if I ever let things go, and they'll let you know the first time I do. hasn't happened yet. My sister's going to write in and be like, you have no idea what I suffer. So I looked up a little unsuccessfully because I don't have a room full of the OED in my house, but I tried to look up where armchair came from as a descriptor of someone who's not an expert talking as if they're an expert.
Oh, uh-huh.
And we use armchair quarterback.
Yeah.
There's armchair psychologist, the armchair expert. What the OED told me before the paywall came up was that it started in the early 1800s as an armchair traveler.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Of someone who spoke about other places, but who had never been there, and they were just reading about it from the comfort of their armchair. And that was its first use. It's something that we all know, but I wanted to see if there was... Anyway, I didn't get to find anything out because I don't have a subscription to the OED. And free etymology is really... It's really shady. It's hard to know what to trust. Anyway, without more OED exposition, all I have is the first armchair was the armchair traveler. What did you look up?
So first of all, I just need to tell you why I looked this up, which is I was on social media and I saw a post from a woman I know. I run this writing program, and a lot of the people who've done it many times over the years were friends on social media. And so one who is a really interesting woman who's a poet and mathematician posted that she had almost made this word in Scrabble, but she was missing an M. And the word was eudaimonia. And that's E-U-D-E-M-O-N-I-A. And she said, I would have been so happy to make the word eudaimonia if I'd had an M. And it's because eudaimonia is often a synonym for happiness, though it comes out of Aristotelian ethics, which is, it's a condition of human flourishing or well-being overall.
Eudaimonia.
Eudaimonia. Often also used as eudaimonic or eudaimonic.
I love it. Eudaimonia?
Mm-hmm.
Human flourishing.
Mm-hmm. Very, very Aristotelian.
What an incredible concept. That GDP is not going to do a good job of getting at.
So for the middle of our show.
For the middle Pilcro, the biggest Pilcro, these conversations tend to have a couple different kind of flavors of like, is it exposition? Or am I trying to pitch something to Robin? Is Robin trying to pitch something to me? Of like, how do we talk about these things that we know about, but we don't know about? And today we wanted to talk about gross domestic product and happiness.
It's funny to me because when we discussed this last week, you were like, oh yeah, we can do this next week. Like you just seemed ready to go.
Oh, I'm totally ready to go. Yeah, I'm ready right now. I was like, we can record today.
But this came up for a couple of reasons. One was somebody posted in our Substack chat about just asking, what if instead of GDP or other traditional economic indicators, what if those are the wrong approach? What if we looked at metrics that are tied to quality of life? And that could be happiness, well-being, mental and physical health, access to nature. And then somebody who's actually a PhD economist replied and said that he agreed that our macro measures are all wrong in terms of telling us how society's doing, but also pointed out we pay attention to what we measure. And until we measure well-being, our economy won't necessarily improve in any substantive way. And so, you know, I thought, well, if I've learned nothing else in talking to Catherine over the years is that we measure a lot. If you want to know something around the U.S. economy, but just also U.S. population, like we have a lot of measures. So part of me thought, well, there's actually some combination of measures that are out there, but also whether GDP serves a particular purpose, because at least in developing countries, you can talk all you want about happiness, but at the end of the day, it tends to track with GDP per capita up to a point.
Up to a point. So when Robin was like, should we do something about GDP being a bad measure? I was like, I'm ready.
Oh, I see. It wasn't the happiness angle. It was GDP.
But happiness is one of many things that GDP doesn't have any account for. It doesn't measure environmental degradation,
yeah,
any measure of quality of life. it doesn't get at happiness. It doesn't get at the fact that like some people do things inside their house that they don't sell and they're totally erased from GDP. It's almost as if they don't exist, including everyone who stays at home to raise children.
First, just as a table setting here, like GDP does seem like the big measure, right? Like
it is the measure.
It is the measure.
Okay. Gross domestic product, aka
it's not
GDP,
a straw man.
Is not a straw man.
I mean, people really do. They refer to GDP measures over time. Like it's the most cited major economic indicator.
Because it is a measure of the size of an economy. Hmm. And gross domestic product, three words that mean almost nothing on their own and certainly mean nothing together, but it's really size. Like how big is the U.S. economy? The answer is GDP.
Can you remind us what the formula is? I feel
oh,
like you told me.
It's C plus G plus X. Sorry. I got so excited. Oh, man. It's C plus G plus I plus X sub N, which is the consumption of households, the
That's
consumption
C.
of governments, the consumption of business,
That's
and
B.
X sub N, which is your net exports. C plus G plus I plus X sub N. Households, businesses, governments, mutually exclusive and exhaustive agents in our economy, add in what we send and get from other places, and you have the size of the U.S. economy. And yeah, I mean, if this number falls, we are almost always in a recession.
Mm-hmm.
If this number grows, it means that we think the economy is strong. And it's not just what it measures, but how people respond to its performance that influence so much about the economy. And it is truly not doing what it was meant to do. Right now, I think the two biggest complaints about GDP is that it doesn't have any type of indication of inequality, and it doesn't have any type of indication of environmental degradation and the use of natural resources. So mm-hmm. one way to think about it is a tree in my front yard that I'm looking at right now has no economic value, but if I were to
cut it down
and sell it, it has economic value according to GDP.
Right.
And so it puts a premium on the sale of things and not the existence of things, which for the environment, that's not good.
Mm-hmm.
And also, if I were to go into my front lawn and like, you know, take the tree and pour acid on it and murder the tree, it wouldn't have any economic consequences,
mm-hmm.
even though I've destroyed part of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe it only would if I like got someone to come clean it up, and then it'll look great because I've paid someone for a service to clean the tree that I've poisoned and killed and taken it off of my front lawn, right? So it focuses on the end dollar amount. So I think a lot of people could listen to this and be like, well, yeah, so of course it's terrible. Why do we use it at all? Like, and the, like you get this like really angry liberal response of like, because people who have all the money don't care about people at the bottom. And I think it's worth going back in history.
What? Yeah.
To
yeah,
talk about where this came from. Guess how far back we get to go.
Ooh, GDP. Okay. I'm going to say 1885.
That's actually a little early.
It was just a guess.
Okay, but there were many panics around that time, which will be useful for this, like the panic of 1873. Yeah. So like, yeah, we could start there. Or probably more importantly, we start in the Great Depression.
Okay. Yeah.
Great Depression. So in the 19-teens, mm-hmm. at this point, the economics profession is in its infancy, right? We're barely a profession. The idea that we have economics degrees, it's only something that's like 20 to 30 years old. And we're still trying to make sense of this big thing we call the economy. And mm-hmm. what a professor, who I think is at Columbia, puts forward is the idea that a capitalist economy has to exist in cycles. And he coins the term and develops the whole kind of framework for thinking of the business cycle, which is you grow, that's an expansion, you then contract, that's a recession, and then you recover. And you kind of go through this process of big expansion, short contraction, big expansion, short contraction. He was trying to make sense of what could predict this, what follows this. And for them, almost every contraction they saw was a depression.
Mm.
And this idea that the economy had some kind of like almost like bloodletting every so often, this became a question of how do we solve this?
And this is the 19 teens. We're not
this
even
is the 19 teens. And then of course in the 20s, everything's awesome.
Everything's great.
Everything's perfect. And then obviously it comes to a screeching halt. And the screeching halt is induced by lots of problems in the economy that come to the head. Things like speculation in the stock market, things like the concentration of wealth in the hands of a few. And not the guy who came up with business cycles, but his student was essentially given the assignment from his mentor and former professor, you know, can we put a set of numbers on the economy to understand what's going on? Because now mm-hmm. we're in the middle of the Great Depression and it's not clear what's working. Mm-hmm. So in January 1934, this kid posits and he presents to the Committee on Finance in Congress an account of national income from 1929 to 1932. So his opening line, they don't write reports like this for Congress anymore, is year in, year out, the people of this country, assisted by the stock of goods in their possession, render a vast volume of work toward the satisfaction of their wants. Apparently, this guy had a PhD in economics. I'm like, whoa, man, that was wasted on you. Look at that turn of phrase. But his name is Simon Kuznets. He was born in Russia. He came to the U.S. around the time that the Russian Civil War ended, and he was one of many Russians that flee the country, came to the U.S., got a PhD at Columbia, where he worked under Wesley Clair Mitchell, who was the founder of the National Bureau of Economic Research, and he was basically assigned with this idea of, like, figure out how we measure the economy. And Kuznets' interests have often been speculated about kind of in the years since of, like, what was he really trying to do? Because the use of GDP evolved as he developed it. So he came up with the idea of using national income to describe and explain long-term trends, as well as measure what is going on in the economy as it's coming out of the Depression. And he's doing this kind of in the 30s. Well, he ends up becoming the chief statistician of the Wartime Production Board in World War II, where the question has morphed from, is the U.S. economy coming out of the Great Recession, and how can we tell and how can we measure it, to how much money can the U.S. government reasonably spend on wartime production? Mm-hmm. Like, is there an amount above which we will hurt the economy if we spend too much money? Mm-hmm. And though the GDP, like measuring the size and measuring the size across every sector and measuring the size across every component, that became a way of both understanding what was going on in the Depression if we were coming out of it, and then answering questions like, so how much can we sink into World War II funds? Like, how big can we go in U.S. government spending go at this point? It's a really, like, kind of fascinating evolution of what his first statistical proposals are used for. But in the background, what he is more interested in, and when World War II is over, what he writes about is how countries continue to grow. So this requires going back to, like, the Middle Ages. But growth in the economy over mm-hmm. millennia can be described as the hockey stick. So, like, if you were to look, like, here's the year 1000 and here's the year, like, 1850, and you're looking at 9 centuries of human history, the economy is basically an absolute flat line.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And then we have the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah.
And it shoots up.
Sure.
Now, we can look back and say, like, oh, it's a hockey stick, right? The growth took off. Once you had the right things come together in Industrial Revolution, your growth accelerates and you break free from the world in which all of us are poor almost all of the time. But where they were, it felt much more precarious. And there was
much more recent, yeah.
And so after the war is done, Kuznets writes this, like, 10-part series on growth. And what he wants to understand is kind of the intersectoral relationships between the growth of an economy and the growth of a sector. Mm-hmm. And he puts numbers to that. So he embarks on this project to basically come up with GDP that's comparable, that has all these separate components for countries all over the world as they're growing, as they're basically in the hockey stick, because he's trying to understand how this growth occurs and if this growth is sustainable. And this is what he wins the Nobel Prize for. So his kind of, like, retrospective of thinking, let's look at the basically intersectoral shifts that happen in an economy as it is growing to understand where growth comes from and how growth can continue.
Can you explain a little bit more about the intersectoral growth?
Like, is one industry too big? Is that become a risk to growth? Which is what, like, this is what people have said about the healthcare sector in the U.S. Like, it's way too big.
It's taking way too much of the economy.
It is way too big. It's way too big of a part of the economy.
Right.
That we have this, like, sector that's growing that's not necessarily adding to productivity or growth or, like, national well-being or anything like that. It's like you could come up with all kinds of reasons, economic and non-economic, for being concerned of how much of the U.S. economy rests on its healthcare sector. Mm-hmm. That was the type of thing he was interested in. Mm-hmm. If farming becomes more productive and you have all this labor that can be used for other things, like, does that mean farming gets smaller? Is really, like, kind of a fascinating look, but it's kind of interesting to the extent that he was interested in history. Like, he was looking backward, right, making sense of what had occurred. He wasn't necessarily looking forward. But of course, that is exactly how GDP ends up being used.
Right.
It ends up being used as a way to measure growth. Mm-hmm. He was coming up with a way to understand growth.
Understand the growth that had happened, and it becomes a way of just measuring it going forward.
Yeah, and so a lot of people will tell you the most pernicious aspect of using GDP as, like, the most important economic indicator is that you're in a growth chase, mm-hmm, and you always have to be growing. And that economies and governments are basically always trying to chase what will make their economy bigger, because that's what GDP is measuring, getting bigger, mm-hmm, or smaller. But for the record, in his 1934 report, he said, the welfare of a nation can scarcely be inferred from a measure of national income.
So that isn't how he saw this ever being used. I don't know that it is used. I think that the question is whether we so prioritize economic growth that we kind of, our eye isn't on these other things that we need to be paying attention to in terms of national policy priorities.
The priority has been growth for so long.
Yeah.
In the maintenance of GDP, in coming up with a way of monitoring the strength of the U.S. economy that devalues this focus on growth, I mean, it's going to be tough. I mean, it's not to say we can't do it, but it's going to be tough. And this hold that GDP has on our economic well-being, I think GDP is vitally important, but it's not everything. Mm-hmm. And we talk so much on the show about how policies have trade-offs. Well, measurements have trade-offs too. And this is a trade-off to focusing on GDP. It doesn't mean that it doesn't have a role. It just means it might have gotten maybe too big for its own britches. That's a technical economic term, listeners. If that's confusing for you, you let me know.
You just said that American policy prioritizes GDP growth and economic growth. Can you talk about some ways that it does that? What policies do we see that in?
Oh man, this is getting into macroeconomics, which is, I'm not going to say it's voodoo economics because somebody else used that line, but it's very much like taking, like, the broadest view of the economy where you're looking at, like, almost like centuries, but not people.
I mean, I certainly hear it, like, people would defend it by saying it will lead to economic growth. I mean, we can agree or disagree about whether that's actually true, but it's an underlying assumption to all that more economic growth is the goal.
Is good.
Not just good, like, is the goal.
Is the goal of we can grow the economy. And so, yeah, I mean, I think if you look at it through, like, eras of thinking about different times, like the U.S., since 1934, when he first introduced the idea of a national income account. If you think of, like, the eras the U.S. economy has been since then, we had this era of, like, really high growth coming out of World War II, in which we generated a lot of income for the bottom, in which we produced a lot of things. And I think someone would could say something like, we seem to have in the U.S. almost like an obsession with the consumption of new goods. Mm-hmm. Which could, in fact, spur economic growth to always be consuming things, mm-hmm, where that's rewarded in the economy, mm-hmm, as opposed to, like, using things for, like, their most utility and, like, buying a product that you only have to buy once for, like, 50 years, that would be valued less in the economy. Now, it's not like policymakers are sitting down in Congress and are like, buy new things every year. That's the law. But we've built into
they do a lot to incentivize that.
We've built into our assessment of economic strength that buying new things is better than using old things. Mm-hmm. Because you're chasing growth.
Right. Right.
it has a purpose. Like, it's very useful in saying things like the economy is slowing down. Like, we just had two GDP reports that came out this year.
Yeah.
And they were very confounding to a lot of people because the first one was negative and the second one was positive. And so we're worried about the effects that tariffs will have on the economy, but they haven't showed up in GDP growth yet. The first quarter's GDP was a little bit negative, and then the second quarter was positive. It was around 3%. And the average over those 6 months was, you know, just over 1% or 1.5%. And what something like the national income product accounts and kind of what Kuznets conceived, you know, all those decades ago, was that you can see what is contributing to this overall number to assess, is the economy actually weak or strong? And in a moment like now, where we are worried about the effect of tariffs, GDP has been incredibly insightful because what we've seen is that the big swing in the headline number from negative to positive is being driven by inventories and swings in trade. But when you look at things like, are consumers doing as well in terms of spending as much as they did last year, the answer is no, it's slowed down. Business spending has slowed down. Consumer spending has slowed down. And so we're able to use these components of GDP to understand what's going on in the economy. Like that, I think he would be like, yeah, exactly that. That's what you, this is why we have it.
It was interesting because like I read a lot of those stories when the latest report came out and a few of them were just like, GDP is up and that's all they're going to say. But other ones would say, the overall GDP figure is up, but that's because imports were down. And imports were down because businesses stocked up because they knew the tariffs were coming. So in other words, we're getting kind of a wash between the buying of everything you could and stopping importing because the tariffs are now into effect. My point is, I guess the economists see that. I don't know that the general public sees that.
And then you can keep going from there. I mean, and so we have lower household consumption, right? This is showing a weakness in the economy. And, you know, Heather Long from the Washington Post, she just wrote about how that consumption number, if you were to dig there and peel that back, we call this a K. The consumption spending in the U.S. is being maintained by the richest households.
Yeah.
And they have been unaffected by almost anything that has happened in the economy over the last 5 years. Yeah, they have money. Like, there is no pandemic when you have money. There's no recession. There's no inflation spike. It just, it doesn't touch you. And there's a lot of them, and their spending is fine. And so what she's pointing out is that if you were to drill in on this number, it is showing this overall weakness where the you got a lot of households at the bottom kind of falling, and then you have households at the top rising. And this creates a K in our economy, and we have a K-shaped recovery. We were worried about having a K-shaped recession. I take, like, a little umbrage to this because my name starts with a K and I feel like it's a pretty cool letter, but like it doesn't actually have that many great things associated with it. So W, I think I just every time it came close, it would come right back to W. I'm like, wait, what did you just say? W. Yeah, but like this data is helpful like for what it reveals more than the number itself. And I think the problem that so many people have with GDP is that like you get that number that says 3% growth in the US economy in the second quarter, and you don't get the same type of emphasis on y'all, our economy is being held up by a small set of rich people who are spending like gangbusters and the rest of us are struggling, right? And that, that there's no measure for how good is that number? Like, what is the quality of that number? And in the 34 report, he says like, this is quantity, not quality. And he got criticized for not including any type of household production, which is what we would call people who were cleaning in your house, making your own food, or, you know, raising children at home. They don't enter GDP at all. And he's like, I know it's a problem. You know, and it was something that he could recognize as a shortcoming, but we don't lead with that shortcoming now. And it's a very, I don't know,
it's kind of a blunt instrument that serves a certain purpose. And
maybe it's like the Swiss Army knife that you've only ever used one tool. Let that sit. Let that sit. Like, let that ping pong that one to see if you like it, because there's a lot we can learn from GDP that's not just
top line number.
You know, the top line number, but that tends to be what influences policymakers the most is the top line number. And not everything that's not in the Swiss Army knife of the like the hook.
I think about this with the tariffs, right? Like tariffs are going to drive down imports and that is going to lead to GDP growth. But it's sort of a cooked books number way to do it.
It's juicing it, for
sure. It's juicing it, yeah.
It's a big juice. So I would say that there's many numbers. The GDP, because it's like the big number, it's the most important one, it makes sense to talk about. But there's a lot of numbers in the economy that have this type of problem. You know, it's not used necessarily in the way that it's intended. It's often misinterpreted. And this kind of goes back to my term and condition of armchair. Once people find the flaw in it, they're like, the economics profession is a lie. I don't know.
Yeah.
The number of times I've been in a setting where someone has been like, you know, GDP doesn't measure quality of life. And I'm like, yeah.
Yeah, I know.
But like, it's almost like once you find out anything bad about an economic statistic, people will like immediately disregard it and instead adopt it almost as like a conspiracy of how economists are trying to ruin the economy.
I did want to point out there's this state of happiness, the World Happiness Report. Are you familiar with this? So it's done by people at a couple of different institutes but based a lot on surveys, global surveys done by Gallup. And what we could see really starkly is that in 2012, the U.S. was number 11 on the list of happiest countries. And in 2025, we're number 24 on that list. And they kind of have a sort of a, again, are you thriving, right? 55% or more of Americans were thriving in the sort of 2015 to 19 period. In our sort of post-pandemic, now it's down to 52.1%. These are self-reported numbers based on surveys of about 1,000 people. They're not perfect. But I think the other thing that was really striking to me and related a little bit to the boys episode and also our talk about poverty, if people over 60 in the U.S. were their own country, they'd be number 10 in terms of happiness ranking in the world. If you were under 30, you're not even in the top 60. Young people are having sort of their own sort of midlife crisis in their 20s. And so when you hear the economy's great, the job unemployment is low, that leads exactly to the disconnect that you're talking about, I think.
Yeah.
And they aren't, is loneliness and is mental health and all this thing, are those related to the economy? Not necessarily, but people feel this tension and that if the economy gets better or if the economy is still good, it's not helping them.
I wrote a piece about this a year or so ago where I point out that averages don't predict individual experiences and individual experiences don't negate the average. And that is one of like the hardest concepts for people to understand. Mm-hmm. You know, that if we say the unemployment rate is 4.2%, we don't mean that like the labor market is strong for everybody. We mean that on average, the labor market is doing well, but then people don't have a job or they're having a hard time finding a job. And like now the unemployment rate has to be a lie.
What's happened with Black women's unemployment in the calendar year so far is sort of staggering. And if you were a Black woman and you knew a lot of Black women, your perception of unemployment would be really at odds with what you're hearing in those unemployment numbers.
Yeah. I mean, it's a confluence of a lot of things and you know, the like siloing of American society into people that look like you and have your same like class and income and education, and the kind of distrust of a lot of voices in our economy and the rise of alternative voices like hack economist on TikTok. But that people look for their own truth and that jeopardizes a lot. And it's funny, I find myself in the position of defending a statistic that I think like mostly it's like fine at best. It's not like I'm sitting here with like a GDP tattoo of like it's CGI. You know, that's not how I feel. I'm kind of like, yeah, I mean, this is like fine. Maybe it was definitely more useful in earlier time periods. We put too much emphasis on it now. But like you end up being in this position of like, but that doesn't mean it's a lie.
Well, and I think that leads to me to also the question of like, if we measured other things, and some of these things we do, I'm sure we do, I don't know. We probably have health statistics, we have educational statistics, like whatever we think that could be other measures of human thriving, of eudaimonia. That's right, used it in a sentence. That how those things become policy or how we alter policy, and especially because some of these are on like timelines that are not quarterly, they're not annual. Like, how do we say investing in children is going to be good for our national happiness dashboard figures? You got to wait a couple generations.
Yeah, you have to, children are like, God, such a loss There's no return on them until like at least 35.
Yeah.
They just eat money. I can't get my kid to eat breakfast, but I'm sure if I put a pile of cash in front of her, she'd figure out how to destroy it. So I think there's optimism there, and that there's more salience for your skepticism of the big numbers than you probably realize.
Yeah.
And that lots of people in power do not like the just like ironclad grip that GDP has on the U.S. economy in terms of performance. And we have lots of ways of measuring something more nuanced, but it doesn't necessarily like move on for that. But I do think I have an optimist story from this.
You do.
Okay, so Kuznets from Russia comes up with GDP, and after World War II, it gets adopted, and it's far beyond what he originally intended, and he was never enthusiastic. He never said it was, like, as good as people said, and he had always warned from the beginning, like, this is not, like, an Inigo, is it Inigo Montoya? Like, you use that word all the time. I don't think you mean, it means what you think it means. Oh, yeah.
Inconceivable. Yeah.
Inconceivable. Yeah, I think he had that, a little bit of an Inigo Montoya warning of, like, I don't know if you know what GDP really means or what it's measuring. Very similar story in relationship to poverty.
Hmm.
So how do we measure poverty in the U.S.? We said in our poverty episode, it's you just have cash that falls under a threshold under which we're poor. So where does that threshold come from? It actually comes from a researcher at the Census Bureau named Molly Orshansky. When you have Social Security benefits, they're automatically adjusted for inflation every year.
Right.
We didn't always do it that way. Mm-hmm. We've only been doing that since the 70s. When Social Security was started, you got a benefit based on your retirement, and you had to wait for Congress to say, we're going to increase every Social Security benefit by like X percent this year. It took an act of Congress to increase Social Security benefits. Well, you could see why this might end up a disaster.
Yeah.
So in the 1960s, there were members of Congress that were like, we have no idea if Social Security's benefits are good enough. Are they high enough? Are they reasonable enough? So a researcher, you know, at the Census Bureau was asked, like, can you come up with a measure of what is enough?
Mm. What's enough to live on?
Yeah, what's enough to live on? In 1955, there had been a survey on consumption of how much money people actually spend in various things of their and various aspects of their life. And what she noticed was that it was a pretty consistent finding that about a third of all household budgets went to food.
Mm-hmm.
If people consistently spend a third of their money on food, the amount they need is three times food. She was like, all right, if we have this measure of like, what is a minimum cost of food? And here's a food plan to help people who don't have that much money afford a reasonable amount of food. And we know that food is a third, like we can come up with a measure of deprivation. So she does three times the food budget. She comes up with a dollar amount. She adjusts it based on the number of people in the household and how old and young they are because they consume different amounts of food. And then she comes up with a measure of here's how many people fall above or below this, and this is the reasonable amount.
And is that what we call the poverty line or the poverty threshold?
Yes, although it takes a while to get there. Then the war on poverty begins. She's not part of the brain trust of Johnson's war on poverty, but they need to come up with a poverty number, and they've read her report, so they pick it up and they use it.
Oh.
And that is how the U.S. poverty line was defined. It was a 1955 survey that found a third of budget went to food. It was put with 1959 data. It was adjusted for inflation every year since. And that is where our poverty measure comes from.
Huh.
I mean, almost as soon as the poverty measure is adopted, it becomes problematic. The only reason why it's so entrenched is that it's eroded over time and it keeps like maybe fewer people eligible for public programs than there would be otherwise.
No, I mean, probably true, but like, you know.
Well, no one wants to say they were in charge of increasing poverty.
Right.
But in the 90s, there was like this really groundswell of like, you have to fix this. Like this measure is terrible. And she would be like, word.
Yeah.
Clinton was kind of moving forward on coming up with a different measure of poverty. Bush, you know, did not move it forward at all. Although he did do a lot for public programs, I think people don't know that he did. He championed SNAP.
Mm-hmm.
He oversaw the change of benefits so that you went from paper to an ATM debit card. But Obama kicked this back off and was like, get me a new poverty measure. And this is where the supplemental poverty measure comes from, where we actually have a government agency that publishes two poverty numbers right next to each other. One of them, the official measure, which is Orshansky's. So some people call the OPM. the official poverty measure, but some people call it the Orshansky poverty measure, mm-hmm. even though she wouldn't necessarily like it. The supplemental poverty measure is produced right alongside it. And this one is like, you know what we should do? We should take into account all the things that people actually spend money on today. And similarly, we should look at all of the resources going into the household, not just cash.
Because it includes things like food stamps. It includes things like housing assistance, maybe.
It includes the taxes you pay, and it includes health spending. It's a very nuanced measure. I think what makes, like, that is the success, right? Like, you can apply pressure. You can have this thing adopted. It's published alongside. And the supplemental poverty measure is very useful because it is where we could see the 2021 expanded child tax credit take a lot of kids out of poverty because they didn't technically get cash income. They got a tax credit. Mm-hmm. So all of that is to say that we have the ability and have demonstrated previously in this country to understand that a statistic sucks. There's too much reliance on it. We need to do something better. Even the person who invented it was like, this is not great.
So great.
And we can come up with an alternative. I think in poverty's case, the wind out of the sails was that neither side felt vindicated by it. Like the people who were like, there's not actual poverty. Like the country is rich. And if you took into account all the money you get from like food stamps, you wouldn't have as much poverty. Well, that didn't turn out to be true. Mm-hmm. And then the people on the other side who were like, people are so poor. Like this measure is not counting correctly. Like you need to adjust for like cost of living across cities. People are going to be really poor. It didn't show up that different. Mm-hmm. And the rates they're not as far apart, I think, as either side wanted of the people who thought that it was an under-measurement of poverty or people who thought it was an over-measurement of poverty. We now have this official statistic metric that looks at every component of what makes life hard to afford and tracks it over time and can say, you know, here is what moves people into poverty or here is what moves people out of poverty by this more nuanced measure. And policymaking has greatly benefited from it. So it's a mixed success. And so, yeah, you're going to read in September. So pretty soon we're going to have Poverty Day where the national poverty estimate is going to be released. And you're going to see that first number of the official poverty measure. And that will be the headline. But what is going to...
That's going to be the Orshansky number.
That's going to be the Orshansky number. But the report is going to include both. And it's going to talk about both. And it's going to show all the weaknesses that come from the other one. So
can we never let go of an old number because we've been tracking it over time and therefore we just need to like have it in perpetuity?
Well, we do like that if you have a really long time series, it's like this is a consistent measure, which has its own usefulness, but it doesn't necessarily have to be so important. But like, no, okay, so someone could become president and say like, all right, you guys, we like... Band-Aid's coming off. We've had both poverty measures for 10 years now. We're closer to 15, and like we're not doing this anymore. The old one, it's now O for old. That is the old poverty measure. We're going with the new one, and what would it require is changing all the federal statutes that rely on the poverty measure. So it would shake up a ton of stuff.
Huh. So we actually have the statistic, but we're not using it?
Well, there's also no groundswell of support to be like, we need to use this different poverty metric that speaks to all these things. It's also a lot more complicated to produce.
It's more complicated.
But mm-hmm. They know they can do it. But at the same time, like for people who look at something like GDP and feel just like, God, this is just like grinding us down because mm-hmm. there's no other measure. We could come up with another measure of GDP or like alternative GDP. Mm-hmm. New Zealand's done this. New Zealand came up with an alternative to GDP and they were like, oh, economy's not as great as we thought. Mm-hmm. So I think it would be the good thing to come out of all of the feeling of economic misunderstanding that people have, mm-hmm. that we were able to develop a better measure. And now some people might be thinking, thank God we just fired the head of the BLS. Because instead of embracing like the use of like alternative statistics and better measures and more modern measures, Trump has in fact fired the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics for political reasons. And it's part of really a multi-fronted attack on all the statistical agencies. And so I think your gut reaction would be
maybe not great. Now.
yeah, like we can do it, but we're not gonna because of this guy. But I would go back to me, this is ultimately an optimistic story because all of those agencies were in trouble. all of those agencies, the Census Bureau, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the Bureau of Economic Affairs, like all of them had been underfunded. All of them had been
under fire.
Struggling to modernize, but didn't have the funds to do it. Like, you know what it takes to develop an alternative measure? Time and money, baby. Like, it's not that complicated, and they got neither. I was doing an interview about the Bureau of Labor Statistics and what it means, and I said, one of the biggest problems that all of the statistical agencies have had is that they've never had a champion. Like, there is no one in Congress who's like, the BLS is, that's one's on me, and I'm going to make sure it's okay. They've never had that. And people have never cared. Like, up until August 1st, did anybody care that the BLS had had 15 years of funding cuts in real terms that left it a shell of its former self, and they were doing their best to maintain production under excruciating and intense circumstances? No. But then he fired her, and it's like, how dare you? Which is great. Like, your knowledge, your anger, your understanding of what's at stake, that's something the BLS has never had. And we have, like, this kind of confluence of things coming together of, like, the statistics don't describe my life. Now you say they're a lie and you're firing people. Turns out these things were on life support anyway. Like, I've never seen so many things come together that could lead to big, beautiful BLS. One big, beautiful BLS. One big, beautiful statistical agency. Like, if there was ever going to be a true, like, renaissance of the statistical agencies,
it may come out of this period.
It would be these things coming together of, like, dissatisfaction with these statistics and then feeling simultaneously the defense of agencies come under attack for just producing them. So there's interest for this. I think change is going to come.
All right. Should we palate cleanse with some executive orders?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, I got to talk so much about statistics. I won't lie. That's a palate cleanse on its own. I don't need a palate cleanse after, like, Kuznets and Orshansky and, like, statistical metrics and, you know, getting to make a full-throated defense of the BLS. Like, what a day.
What a day. So happy we could be here for you and help make this happen. Okay, executive orders. So, a guy named Jeff Martz became a paid subscriber on Substack, I think. Anyway, he became a member of the Optimist community and sent in this executive order. Jeff says, as an Appalachian Trail maintainer in Pennsylvania, my executive order is that every member of Congress who wants to vote to cut funding to a national park must hike the most difficult trail in it, and they are only allowed to continue with their vote if they complete the trail without a change of heart. Otherwise, their vote automatically goes to increasing funding for that particular park. Endorse.
Yes. I cannot endorse this enough.
And relatedly, I wanted just to show you this. So we got a postcard from a listener who is actually hiking the Pacific Crest Trail. And she sent this from the halfway point, which is in Chester, California. I won't read the whole thing here. But anyway, they came in the same week. And I love the idea that she's out there hiking the trail, listening to Optimist Economy.
Oh my goodness. Jeff, that is a great idea. Oh, can you imagine a bunch of, like, people
I want to see Mitch McConnell
That's definitely going to, that's like quasi-ageist, and I don't mind it. Yeah. I don't mind it at all. Oh man.
All right. And your executive order?
My executive order is, if you would like to boo or yell or say mean things at a sporting event, you have to be in your own section. And
the mean supporters?
The mean section. They just need their own space. Because I've thought about, like, I understand, like, you don't want to yuck someone's yum. But I hate being next to people who, at the sporting events, who are yelling so cruelly and so constantly.
So are you specifically upset by the people who are criticizing the players? I just say this as someone who sits next to someone who likes to yell at the refs a lot.
But, like, even refs, I don't know. I don't really like being next to people who are, like, screaming at full volume negative things. It makes it very hard for me to enjoy something because it's, like, that sense goes up of, like, I'm in danger. Like, yeah. Is that Ralph that's surrounded by fire from The Simpsons? Or he's like, I'm in danger. Like, I cannot relax and enjoy a sporting event. And also, and then there's that second part of like, if you go with kids and yeah. you end up sitting next to someone who is yeah, like yelling sure. profanities and screaming, like you either have to spend the entire game telling your kid, like, by the way, don't say that, or like you leave the game.
Yeah.
So I don't.
I do love women's soccer games, because they do tend to have fewer of this.
Oh, sorry. This action. Is a male sporting event thing. Women's sporting events. No, girl, you're not yelling. Like, I can't tell you how mad it makes me to watch a professional women's soccer game with the knowledge that I probably earn more money than everyone on the field. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that is so not right. And then when someone's like, what are you doing? I'm like, you need to sit down.
That poor woman's
making... How dare you speak to her like that? Like, how dare you? Ref, I would say, is a little bit more neutral territory, but my whole thing about yelling is just how uneducated people are when they're yelling at a soccer ref. Of like, that's a foul. It's like, she's on the other side of the field. Like, how would you possibly know it's a foul? Most of the times when I'm going to a soccer game in particular, like, I'm very intensely watching. Like, I just love seeing, like,
watch plays come together. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, watch plays come together and, like, watch the movements. I'm a little bit of a mutterer where I'm like, oh, look at that pass. Look at that. God, that was a great combination. And, like, and, you know, just like slowly sipping a beer and, like, muttering of, like, just like, good job again. God, you guys, it's great. And then when there's a bad call, I'm like, ah, no, sir. You know, I just. I just don't like being around large groups of mad people. But like, does that mean I don't get to enjoy sports in person? Or maybe there's a quiet section. This is, okay, I think I've actually thought about this completely wrong. Maybe I need to go Amtrak style. And actually, you just need a quiet section. Like, we don't encourage yelling. Yeah, having more sections of stadiums akin to the quiet car and the loud car.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Man, I don't really come with these things fully formed, do I?
Glad we could talk that out. Glad we could talk that out.
Yeah. All right. Okay. And that's our show on Catherine's in-person sports preferences.
Okay. It's time for spiritual sponsors. Jeremy from Cross Plains, Wisconsin is a new spiritual sponsor on the show. Thank you, Jeremy. We really appreciate that. He sent us a message that said, more than any other podcast, Optimist Economy makes me hit the pause button and reflect on what's being discussed. For instance, seating charts in stadiums. And my personal spiritual sponsor this week is the Farmers Market at Fairfax and Third in Los Angeles. I know it's a touristy kind of place, but really it's one of the great places in LA. It's got a great history and people just love being there, and there's food everywhere and just tables where you can sit. And it's a spirit lifting place.
My spiritual sponsor this week is the live oak tree. Mm. Now that I am back close to the Gulf where I belong, live oak trees are all around Houston, and I happen to have two in my front yard, and they're massive, they're mm-hmm. shaded, and I relish in knowing that the two in our front yard are 80 years old, so they're babies. They'll live for 400 more years.
We have live oaks in California live oaks, and there's a particular path in Griffith Park that's just lined with them, and it's the best sort of shady trail. A lot of horseback riders take it on the north side of the park. It's just great.
Yeah, ours are covered in resurrection ferns, which is also fun. Mm-hmm. So it's, yeah. Trees.
Big trees. Trees.
Everybody be quiet while I watch soccer and sit next to my tree.
I'm glad you're not pouring acid on that tree. Okay. As always, thanks very much for listening to our show. We appreciate it. We appreciate the contributions you send, the reviews you leave for us, those of you who subscribe to our newsletter, and those of you who make us laugh. We also want to thank Andy and Sophie. Andy produces our video, and Sophie produces our audio.